Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Burlington Northern against the United States. Very well argued. I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. In October of 1976, the Interstate Commerce Commission prescribed a rate of $10.93 per ton applicable on coal moving from Wyoming to San Antonio, Texas. Its action in the so-called San Antonio 1 case was an interim measure to get the coal moving, and the Eighth Circuit sustained it, in part on the basis that it was temporary. Now, in reopening, in 1978, the Commission in the San Antonio 2 case modified its prior order by eliminating the prior rate prescription and imposing a rate ceiling of $16.12 a ton. This is not the prescription of a particular rate, but a ceiling, that is to say, a maximum level. The Commission's decision at D18 of the appendix makes it clear and says, quote, "It is not in any sense a requirement that the railroads increase their rates on this traffic to any particular level." Following that decision, the railroads did in fact file a tariff at the $16.12 level. Then on petition for administrative review in 1979 in San Antonio 3, the Commission modified its decision and set a higher rate ceiling of $17.23. Now, it should be noted that the railroad's obligation to collect and the shipper's obligation to pay the rate derives not from the Commission's order establishing any particular ceiling, but from the fact that the rate is filed in a tariff with the Interstate Commerce Commission. If the tariff were less than the ceiling, then the tariff is what the shipper would pay, not the ceiling. Now, following San Antonio 3, the railroad sought review in the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit on the ground that the ceiling was arbitrary, capricious, and unlawfully low. And San Antonio also appealed, contending that the decision was arbitrary and that the rate that resulted was too high. Now, the D.C. Circuit, in its first decision in June of 1980, concluded that the Commission's San Antonio 3 rate ceiling was arbitrary. It lacked adequate rationale, and the cost findings were not adequately supported. The entire decision in June of 1980 dealt with the new ceiling and whether it was adequately explained and supported. The Court did not in that decision discuss at all whether the 1978 decision of the Commission to lift the 1976 prescription was proper. The only question was the validity of the new ceiling and whether it was rationally supported. Now, after the Court of Appeals decision, and commencing with shipments moving on July 24, 1980, San Antonio quit paying the tariff rate and commenced paying at a level of $15.83 a ton, which it calculated to be the old 1976 interim prescription, increased by general rate increases that had occurred since that time. And from July 24, 1980 to May 7 of 1981, when they resumed paying at the tariff level, the difference between the tariff that was in effect and on file at the Commission and the rates that they actually paid amounted to approximately $20 million. Now, after they quit paying at the tariff level and after other attempts to compel them to pay at that level failed, the railroads petitioned the D.C. Circuit to clarify that its decision with respect to the ICC's orders in San Antonio 2 and 3 did not affect the railroad's tariffs that were on file at the Commission.
Do you have any regrets at having made that decision to petition for clarification?
I think not, because we were in a position in the fall in which we were not getting our tariffs paid, and we had to do something to clarify the problem, and we believe that under Wichita, the Court's decision in 1980 had not acted to revive the prior rate prescription and had not had any effect at all with respect to our tariffs. We thought that the quickest way of getting a resolution to that issue was to go back to the D.C. Circuit. Hopefully they would rule that their order related only to the Commission's orders and not to the railroad's tariffs.
Did you give any consideration to going before the Commission?
Well, we did go before the Commission virtually simultaneously. We did, in fact, file a tariff again at the San Antonio 3 level. In other words, we believe, as we told the court, that our tariff on file had not been invalidated by a revived order, but just in case it had, and to be careful, we filed a new tariff at exactly the same level and went to the Commission and said, allow this to become effective if, in fact, it's necessary to do so.
Mr. Martin, did the railroads argue below that the CADC should not declare the tariffs unlawful because San Antonio failed to comply with the filed rate doctrine?
Yes. Yes, we did. That there were about four or five railroad submissions to the D.C. Circuit on clarification. I can't give you a page reference, but it was in there. Now, the effect of the court's clarification in June of 1981, this is the second D.C. Circuit order, was to construe its earlier 1980 decision as requiring the railroads to roll back their tariff to the San Antonio 1 level pending further proceedings before the Commission. And the court then, rather than the Commission, decided what the railroad's rate should be during the course of the remand proceedings. We believe that that decision, both with respect to the revival of San Antonio 1 and the, quote, unlawfulness of the railroad's tariff, is an error. First, with respect to the scope of authority of a reviewing court, we believe that under this court's decisions in Arrow, Scrap, Wichita Board, and most recently Conrail v. Neri, the Commission has the exclusive jurisdiction to decide what the level of the rates or the tariffs should be and whether particular rates or tariffs violate provisions of the Act or prior ICC regulations or rulings. We believe that reviewing courts have no power to determine what the rates should be. The court's function is to review and, where appropriate, set aside Commission orders, which is not the same thing as setting aside or passing on the validity of the carrier's tariffs. Conrail v. Neri is the most recent decision of this court on point. In that case, the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit had vacated an ICC order that had established maximum rates on recyclables equal to 180% of variable cost. The court had gone beyond invalidating the order and also ordered that carrier rates filed pursuant to the 180% ceiling must be revoked. And this court summarily reversed, holding that the Commission's failure to adequately support the 180% ceiling did not mean that the ceiling or rates set at that ceiling were, quote, rejected outright. As this court pointed out, rates up to that ceiling might eventually prevail at the Commission. There was thus no basis for that portion of the Court of Appeals order which had gone beyond striking down the order and invalidating the carrier's tariffs. Now, that case is squarely on point in rejecting the proposition that the function of a reviewing court is to restore the status quo ante, which is what the Court of Appeals in this case did. The function of the reviewing court is not to restore the status quo ante. It is to allow the Commission on remand to decide the validity of the carrier's rates. Now, that is very close to what happened in this case, where the Commission's San Antonio 3 decision establishing a rate ceiling was set aside because the rationale was not adequate. But the Court of Appeals' first decision in 1980 left open the possibility that rates at that same level might eventually prevail after the Commission's proceeding on remand. The problem is that if the Court's 1981 decision, which is here on review, is valid, it would mean that for some interim period of time, the old 1976 temporary rate would apply, and no matter what the Commission might decide on the remand, the carriers could never recover their tariff rate for that interim period. Now, the Court below recognizes these consequences of its decision, but it, in effect, blames them on the revived 1976 order of the Commission. However, there is nothing in Wichita, nothing in Conrail v. Neri, which suggests that the holding of those cases depended on whether the Commission had issued one order or two orders or 10 orders. So long as the tariff rate might eventually prevail on remand before the Commission, then the reviewing court has no power to interfere with the tariff. We believe that's the holding of Conrail v. Neri. This limitation on a reviewing court's power would apply even if San Antonio 1 had been revived. In fact, the Commission in 1976 had clearly intended that the order be temporary to get the traffic moving. This is in the appendix at E13 and F2. And by its own terms, the 76 order had life only, quote, until the further order of the commission, end quote. And such a further order was, in fact, issued in 1978. Thus, by its own terms, the original 1976 order ceased to have any effect 2 years before the period in question here. But even more fundamentally, the commission did not bring the 1976 order back to life in 1980 or in 1981. The commission has never ruled, never found that a reasonable maximum rate for 1980-81 would be at the San Antonio 1 level. In fact, in its April 1981 decision, the commission concluded that the San Antonio 1 rate was, quote, several years out of date, that's at F4 in the appendix, and, quote, cannot have continued validity because of the new statutory threshold on ICC maximum rate jurisdiction and because of the changed statutory standard since 1976. That's at F8 in the record. So the question really is where an agency rate order, which was temporary in the first place, expires, where the agency has not itself brought the order back to life, and where the agency, in fact, believes that the old order is out of date and wrong and would not be revived, it was up to the commission, can a reviewing court bring it back to life for the period
is
of the remand?
In the commission procedures, is there any practice of a parallel to the one in probate matters of a dependent relative revocation so that when a subsequent order is set aside, it revives the last preceding?
No, Your Honor. And the reason for that is
Have they ever done that?
No, Your Honor, and the reason for that is because of the interrelationship between the tariffs which are on file and the maximum rate orders. The commission can fully protect everyone, and that's the difference, where you've got a will and another will. What do you do in the meantime? Well, you don't have that problem in the ICC or in other statutory situations that are built on the Interstate Commerce Act because there's a tariff there. And if the tariff turns out to have been too high, the commission can award reparations and protect everybody. In other words, if we had a $20 tariff on file and the commission ultimately concluded it wasn't 15, it was 17 and a half, that would have been a fair maximum reasonable rate for that interim period of time. The commission isn't stuck with the alternative of either the $20 or the $15. It can say 17 and a half was the maximum, pay the reparations back to the 17 and a half to make the shipper whole for the excess of the tariff during that period, and pay them interest. It can do that, and it has done that. Now, what it cannot do is authorize the railroads to go back and, once its tariff has been reduced, collect more. In other words, if our tariff was reduced from $20 to $15 for an interim period of time, and the commission later concluded that it really ought to have been 20 or 22 or 18 or anything above that, there's no power to authorize the railroads to go back and retroactively collect that higher amount from the shipper. But the reason that the will situation really isn't analogous is because of the commission's flexibility to determine what between the 20 and the 15 is a fair rate and
in other
protect
words,
everybody.
When they entered a new tariff, that nullified any prior tariff.
Well, what would happen is that
the
commission wouldn't enter a tariff. The carriers go file a tariff, and the tariff becomes the rate that has to be paid by virtue of the fact that it's filed. And what the commission would do is look at the tariff and say, is that too high or unlawful for any reason? Now, if after having looked, it says that that $20 tariff is too high, we hereby order the railroads to reduce it. And then two things happen. For the future, once the tariff is reduced, that reduced tariff becomes the rate that the shipper has to pay. And so for the future, we're taken care of. Now, the question is, what do you do about the past? And if the 20 ought to have been 17 and a half, the shipper is protected by the reparations and the interest on the reparations. But the problem we've got is that if, when an order is set aside that had approved a higher rate, the effect of that order is automatically to invalidate not only the order but our tariff and make our tariff unlawful for some period in the past, and it gives the commission no opportunity to make a determination of whether it was reasonable or not, then we are stuck because there's nothing we can do for that interim period of time, and here it was 9 months and $20 million. Now, the problem here is not simply one of exceeding the court's jurisdiction to review orders. It interferes directly with the statutory rate-making scheme. Because you have a period of rising costs and changing regulatory standards, it is not at all uncommon for the ICC or other regulatory agencies to issue a succession of rate orders that will reflect successively higher maximum rates, which is what happened here. Under this ruling, whenever one such order is set aside on review, the last prior lawful order would bounce back into effect, revived for some period of time. And that would happen no matter how outdated the prior order was, and here it was 1976 to 1980, and it would apply no matter how inconsistent that revived order is with the changed statutory standards. And here we had two new statutes that had come into effect.
Do you think the Court of Appeals, Mr. Martin, was attempting to interpret commission intent in deciding the effect of its previous order, or that its ruling as to the effect of its own decision or order wasn't based on what it conceived to be the intent of the commission?
It said that it was not based on its own intent or subjective determination as to what the rate level should be, and it said that it was the effect of its order. It did not go into the question of what the commission intent was in 1976 or what the commission's intent would be in 1980. It simply ruled in a more or less mechanical way without looking at anybody's intent that the rate was revised. But the problem here is not only that time has passed, but that in 1976 the commission passed a new rule of rate making, 10704B2 of the statute. That was not applied in the 1976 first order, because that proceeding was in midstream by the time the Act was passed, but it was a brand new rule of rate making. And then again, in 1980, the Staggers Rail Act changed the rate making standards some more. And the problem is that that San Antonio 1 rate, which goes back to 1976 and was intended to be temporary and interim in the first place, doesn't begin to reflect those changed regulatory standards. Now, I might just go to the, I see that my light is on. I'd like to reserve my time, if I may.
Mr. Martin, would you clarify one thing for me before you sit down? And that is, San Antonio apparently applied in October of 1980 with the Tariff Integrity Board challenging the tariffs in effect. Now, did San Antonio appeal from the order that resulted from that?
No, ma'am, they did not. Their position with the Tariff Integrity Board was that our tariff, which was on file, ought to be rejected because it's inconsistent with the Court of Appeals decision and the Tariff Integrity Board, a letter from Mr. Diesenkotter, which is in this supplemental brown volume of documents, rejected that and said there's been no order of the commission directing that the tariff be rejected or reduced.
And did San Antonio ever actually file a complaint with the commission or just something
No.
with the board?
No, they did not. They took the position that the Court of Appeals decision had given them the relief they wanted. They didn't have to go to the commission.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Shoulder.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the United States and the Interstate Commerce Commission agree with petitioners that the Court of Appeals decision in this case violates the rule against judicial rate-making established in this Court's Wichita and Conrail decisions. The decision below basically interferes with the Commission's exclusive authority to determine proper rates, and it reaches an inequitable result. San Antonio has argued that Wichita and Conrail are distinguishable because they do not involve successive rate orders. But the effect of the Court's holding an earlier ICC order revived and declaring inconsistent tariff rates unlawful is precisely the same as if the Court had directly enjoined the railroads from collecting tariff rates during the period in question. In either situation, the Commission is precluded from making its own determination of the proper rate levels. The Court of Appeals' remand decision left open the possibility that the San Antonio rate level would prevail. Now, under the teaching of Wichita and Conrail, the proper role of the Court of Appeals in this situation should have been to preserve the agency's authority to determine what rates are reasonable for the period on remand. However, the Court, rather than preserve the Commission's authority, essentially has usurped the authority of the Commission by declaring the tariff rates unlawful during the period.
Well, the Commission didn't think so initially, did it?
Well, the Commission,
did it think it was being usurped, but that it would just knuckle down to it?
Well, the Commission's initial position was that that the legal effect of the Court of Appeals' remand decision was to revive the San Antonio 1, the earlier Commission
order.
But
its attitude wasn't that that was proper.
Its attitude was that that created an inequity and that the Court of Appeals should try to correct the inequity.
Was its position, however, that the Court had overstepped its authority, or did it take a position on that?
No, I don't believe it took a specific position on that. However, after this Court's decision in Conrail came down, the Commission changed its position and affirmatively told the Court of Appeals that the Court of Appeals' position was incorrect.
But that, Conrail wasn't the first case of this genre, was it?
Well, Conrail was the first case in which a majority of this Court held that a reviewing court has no authority at all in which to set rates or determine rate policy in the context of a remanded proceeding. Now, the argument that the Court of Appeals overstepped its bound under Wichita and Conrail, we feel, is also supported by the filed rate doctrine. If we look at the record in this case, the only tariff that was on file during the remand period at issue here, the 10-month, 9 or 10-month period at issue, was tariff filed at the San Antonio 3 level. There was, in fact, no tariff on file governing the movements in question at the level of San Antonio 1. Yet, during the entire period in question here, San Antonio paid only the rate at the San Antonio 1 level. The Court's decision by declaring tariff rates here unlawful has rewarded San Antonio's resort to self-help and, in effect, sanctioned San Antonio's violation of the filed rate doctrine. The filed rate doctrine has its origins in the Interstate Commerce Act, which requires shippers to pay and carriers to collect only filed tariff rates. If a shipper believes that a filed tariff rate is unlawful, either because it's inconsistent with the Commission rate order or for any other reason, the proper remedy is to challenge the filed rate before the Commission. And if the Commission at that point finds the rate unlawful, it may award the shipper reparations for any overcharge and any interest. Thus, the shipper is fully protected by the statutory scheme. San Antonio, however, has argued that it is excused from paying the tariff rate for this period because the Act prohibits carriers from publishing or collecting rates in excess of those prescribed by the Commission. But the question here is what rate the shipper must pay when there is an ongoing dispute over whether the tariff rate is in violation of the Commission's order. It is not up to a shipper like San Antonio or even to the Court of Appeals to decide in the first instance whether a tariff rate is or is not unlawful. The Commission is not arguing here that filed rates are automatically the lawful rates that govern a particular movement in question, but that the determination of lawfulness of rates is for the Commission to make. The only way to preserve the Commission's authority to make that determination, we submit, is to adhere to the filed rates with the remedy, of course, of reparations in the event the shipper wishes to file a complaint contesting the validity of the tariff rate. Thus, the purpose of the filed rate doctrine essentially is to provide a rigid rule. That is, the shipper must pay the filed rate until a dispute over the proper rate is resolved by the Commission. The filed rate doctrine, therefore, like the rule in Wichita and Conrail, preserves the Commission's jurisdiction over rates. The Court of Appeals decision in this case, however, violates both the Wichita and Conrail and the filed rate doctrines. Accordingly, for the reasons I've stated and those we've stated in our briefs, the Commission and the United States respectfully request that the judgment of the Court of Appeals be reversed.
Would you comment, just to refresh my recollection, on the appealability question, the jurisdictional question? Whether it's timely.
San Antonio has raised the point that the petition in this case was not timely filed because it was filed in excess of 90 days from the Court of Appeals' initial remand decision. However, we agree with petitioners that the remand decision did not resolve the question that is at issue here and that the Court dealt with in its June 1981 decision, which is before the Court now, the decision on the petition for clarification of mandate. The earlier remand decision said nothing about whether or not its order remanding the case to the Commission for further proceedings and explanations would act to revive the earlier Commission order. Accordingly, we agree that there is no question of jurisdiction over this case.
Was there any order entered or any mandate handed down by the Court of Appeals with respect to Judge Wilkie's opinion? Or does opinion stand simply alone?
You mean on the petition for clarification of mandate?
Yes. Not the petition, but Judge Wilkie's opinion is here, of course. The question is whether or not an order was entered. It probably is in the paper somewhere, but I just haven't seen it.
I'm not aware one way or the other.
Is there any mandate from which an appeal is taken? I guess that's my question.
I'm not aware one way or the other whether there was a subsequent mandate issued at that point. Thank you.
Mr. Slover.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court, I represent the City of San Antonio, one of the respondents in this case. In their arguments on brief and in their presentations to the Court this morning, the petitioners and the federal respondents raised three separate and distinct allegations of error in connection with the decision of the Circuit Court below. First, they contend that the decision violates the principles which this Court has enunciated in the line of decisions beginning with Arrow and culminating recently with Conrail. They contend that the decision violates those principles whether or not the San Antonio 1 rate order was restored or not. Secondly, they assert that the Court erred in finding that the San Antonio 1 rate order had continued in effect. And finally, they charge that the Court below erred in its decision and that it violated the filed rate doctrine. Now, in the time allotted to me, and hopefully in quite a bit less, I'm going to try to respond to each of those three arguments. But before I do, I would like to emphasize one aspect by way of factual background, and that is the significance of this San Antonio 1 rate order. It has a very practical significance to my client because it has been the only constraining force against runaway rail prices during the nation's energy crisis. And secondly, it is extremely critical to this litigation because all of this voluminous record, and indeed we submit this very action before the Court today, is one of a series of unceasing efforts by the railroads to extricate themselves from the constraint of the order. So as we go through each of these arguments, we submit that the very distinguishing feature is the San Antonio 1 order itself. And in that connection, this case is a very unique case in the sense that the very, very little railroad transportation takes place under prescribed rates. A statistically immeasurable amount of transportation is taking place with rate prescriptions and virtually very little experience in successive orders. So you have here a very unusual situation. Now, as I say, the basic allegation of error is that the Court below violated the this Court's rules in Wichita and Conrail. And those rules, very generally speaking, divide the functions between the judiciary and, in this case, the Interstate Commerce Commission. They draw a line of demarcation where this Court has suggested that the laws and the policy of the Congress have ousted the federal judiciary from taking injunctive action. And their basic allegation asserts that the Court below crossed over this forbidden line into this forbidden territory in its decision. Now, I think I fairly stated what they're saying, but how the Court did it is not nearly as clear. And what they have done, or what they are seeking this Court to do, is to stretch and expand the principles and boundaries that exist today in the Arrow line of decisions. And basically, they're very easily stated. In Arrow and Scrap, the Court concluded that the federal court should not take injunctive action prior to the time that the Interstate Commerce Commission has acted finally. And in Wichita and Conrail, they concluded that the court should not take intrusive injunctive action where the ICC has acted finally, but the court reverses or remands that action. So we have a body of law that ousts the federal judiciary from taking a preclusive or injunctive action
in these rate-making areas. Now, of course, here there isn't any injunction. So what my opponent's case comes down to is this word effects. They're asking you here today to buy the effects test. They're saying when a reviewing court reaches an action which affects rates, then that should be discouraged in the same way that overt injunctive action is.
Wasn't the Court of Appeals action, however, equivalent to something like an injunction?
Well, I think we would all agree, as the Court said, that the effect of its action was the same. But the distinction as we see it is that unlike the Wichita case, here the Court was doing something that it was eminently qualified to do. It was construing an order. And the considerations which caused this Court to oust the judiciary in Wichita and Conrail are no way applicable to the construction of orders.
Let's assume that ultimately it was found that their action was correct. Why wasn't the proper approach to it to let these rates remain in effect and adjust whatever equities might be found by reparations?
Well, of course, Your Honor, we submit that this Court's decision in the Arizona grocery case is dispositive on that point, that neither the Commission, other words, for example, the Commission itself could not have at the end of the proceeding said, we've examined this initial rate and we find that at some point in the past it became unsatisfactory, so we're going to set a rate for the future and also adjust for the past. That process could not have taken place with or without the district, the circuit court action. So the rate prescription order can never be retroactively adjusted under the rulings of this Court in Arizona Grocery.
Either way.
That's correct. The Arizona Grocery was the other situation.
If the rate proves too low, the railroads can never go back.
That is exactly what that case says. So the difficulty that we have with the so-called effects test that they're striving to extend Conrail beyond injunctions is that none of the considerations which bothered the Court in Conrail, in other words, when a court enters an injunction, it has to decide, one, who's going to win on the merits or the probability of success, and secondly, irreparable injury. Now, in Conrail, the Court said that the federal court should not be engaging in these type of considerations, which in the first instance should initially be considered by the Commission. They felt that the injunctive process was intrusive upon the Commission's area of expertise. But there's no expertise in this case. The Court simply construed a rate order, an order which this Court has held has the force of a statute. None of the considerations behind Conrail apply to a judge's or a circuit court's construction of a rate order. So
well,
we submit.
Small, do you think that the Court of Appeals here did try to determine what the Commission had intended by its various San Antonio orders?
I do not know the answer to that. I know that they had the order before it. This Court has said that that rate orders are unique. They have the force of statute. They speak for themselves. And indeed, at that particular time, there was not the controversy which has been generated after the fact. So we submit that the Court was eminently qualified to construe a rate order, and that is, in fact, what it did.
When you say it construed the rate order, I take it then you mean it construed the effect that that it thought the Commission would want the rate order to have.
I simply don't know that I would go that far. I think that they had the rate order in their hand, and it said this order shall remain effective, etc., until modified. They had vacated the modification, and again, I feel that that the court was not taking injunctive action or any of this type of activity that this court has precluded, but rather was simply engaging in the uniquely judicial process of interpreting and construing an official document.
What do you do about the filed rate?
Well, point?
Because I guess there was a tariff outstanding.
Well, let me say about the filed rate. First of all, I would disagree with my colleague in connection with his response to Justice O'Connor that this this theory was ever really broached to the court below. But as to the filed rate doctrine, so to speak, I think that's really a bad rap against the court below. The more that I thought about this argument, the more I began to think that that the court below and Judge Wilkie never got into whether we were paying too much or too little or who had to pay whom. The filed rate doctrine deals with the railroads collecting charges and tariffs and possibly our paying charges, et cetera. Wilkie never talked about that. Wilkie talked about the priority.
It may not have ever been posed there, but it's been posed here.
Well, it.
And do you think that it's properly posed here?
I do. I absolutely do not.
Well,
I think,
assume we disagree with you. How do you respond to the filed rate?
Well, I think that the Interstate Commerce Act is very clear because the provision, section 107601, that requires the carriers to file the rates is subject to the exception that where there are outstanding rate orders, they are forbidden from publishing, charging, or collecting any other rate but the rate in the order. So we simply say that the statutory source of the rate filing in this statutory scheme is preempted by another part of the statute. And indeed, that is exactly how we read Arizona Grocery. Arizona Grocery says when you have the rate order, you have to obey it. You can't throw a tariff in the front door that has some other rate and then have a lawsuit as to whether that was right or
but
wrong.
But the tariff was filed pursuant to another rate order,
which the circuit court vacated.
Well, yes, but the tariff was still there.
Well, the tariff was still there,
wasn't it?
Well, it was. And again, Justice O'Connor mentioned whether we had filed a complaint, and indeed we did file a complaint about that, and it continues to languish at the Commission today. It was never acted upon, but we took every action. We do not control this pricing. They control these.
What's the railroad supposed to do is it supposed to withdraw that tariff or file a new one or what?
That's what we would submit. We would submit that the because the order continued in full force in effect, the railroads who control this pricing, in other words, they control the.
Say that the net effect then of the Court of Appeals order was it required the railroads to file a new tariff?
Absolutely.
And then you say that's not contrary to the filed rate doctrine.
Yes, we would submit that, or an exception. And while we're on the filed rate doctrine.
May I interrupt with a question there?
Yes,
under
sir.
Your view, could the railroads have immediately refiled the existing tariffs?
They could not have. The other thing
could
about
they file any tariff above the San Antonio 1 rate?
Yes, we submit that the tariffs become secondary on the statutory scheme to the rate order. The rate order, under this court's decision in Arizona Grocery, is the equivalent of a statute. It is a much higher.
Well, then they could not have exceeded the San Antonio 1 rate under your view.
Yes, we submit that they could not have filed tariffs in excess of the San Antonio 1 rate.
So there just is no room for a filed tariff. Wouldn't have done any good to file another tariff then.
They could have filed one at the San Antonio, but we take
well,
the.
Why would they do that?
That the order is in effect. You either file at the order or the order supplants the tariff.
Well, but they have to file tariffs.
And your point is they should have filed a tariff and had to file a tariff at the San Antonio level.
They had to conform their tariff to that order, which at that point was the only viable order. The additional point I want to make on this filed rate doctrine, which I persist is a sort of an add-on to this case, is that all of these cases deal ultimately with who has to pay what at the end of the litigation. I'm not certain that any of them, or there is any particular body of law that says that we have to pay up first and argue later. They have a case pending in the United States District Court in Texas to get the filed rate. And really, I think what their proposition comes down here to is that somehow we have to pay first and argue later. And I'm not so certain that even if you came and found that that the rates they file are the filed rates and they have to charge them, that we have to pay them pending the litigation. So
that's really what the filed rate doctrine is all about, isn't it?
I do not see it as that, no.
Well, you think you could pay some other rate than the filed rate?
We believe that if you have, in other words, there are cases that if you have loss and damage, if your goods are set off, that you can set off.
But supposing it's just a disagreement about the reasonableness of the filed rate.
Then we submit that we could withhold payment pending litigation. Yes, that would be our position.
Is there some case from this court that supports that?
Well, in many of the cases that have been cited in the briefs, that is what in fact took place. We have cases where, not in this court, Your Honor, but there are cases where the issue of what has to be paid pending the litigation is discussed, and they appear not to require that we pay and then argue.
But the Court of Appeals left open the possibility that the San Antonio 2 and 3, is that what you call them?
Yes.
San Antonio 2 and 3 rates, or the San Antonio 3 rates, could be reestablished by the Commission.
Yes, Your Honor, but not retroactively.
Well, I don't know. The possibility was that those rates would be reestablished, and that the Commission would have said that's what they always should have been.
But, Your Honor, that's a critical distinction in this case. They cannot go backwards on the rate order.
The Commission could leave in effect that tariff. Now, when a railroad files a new tariff, the Commission can suspend it if it wants to.
That's correct.
And I suppose on their remand, if the Commission wanted to, it could have suspended that tariff.
Well, of course, at the time this litigation came up, as you mentioned in the direct arguments, the Commission was taking our position.
Yes, I
know. They had attempted to file tariffs, and they did take the position that we espouse, namely that tariffs in conflict with the rate order could not be filed. Now,
they've already filed.
Well, they were filed, but we consider them to be null and void.
The Commission never ordered them suspended or revoked or withdrawn.
But we conclude that they were null and void because they were in conflict with the outstanding rate order. Now, as I say, the real heart of the position of the petitioners in the final analysis, as we read it, comes down to a series of efforts to, in essence, make the San Antonio 1 rate order go away. If you make the San Antonio 1 rate order go away, then you don't have to extend Conrail. You have Conrail. Without the San Antonio 1 rate order, there isn't any question that the court below would have taken the prohibited type interference.
Assuming hypothetically that this court reverses the Court of Appeals, what's the posture of the carrier with respect to the San Antonio 1 rates that are being charged?
Well, see it, if you reverse the Court of Appeals, you would have to also reverse yourself in Arizona Grocery. That's
let's lay that aside for the moment. We'll decide that later. But what is the posture of the carrier if we reverse? What do they do about having
as you understand,
the $11 rate
this proceeding is going on in various continuing facets, and I presume that if you were to reverse, this disputed period would become part of that ongoing proceeding. But I'm speculating.
May I ask you, I know you rely heavily on Arizona Grocery. Isn't that a case in which the court held that reparations could not be granted when the rate had previously been determined to be lawful by the commission, and the commission later changed its mind?
Well, as Mr. Justice White mentioned, I think that's the Arizona Grocery situation is something of the reverse of this situation, where the commission prescribed a higher rate, and then they prescribed a lower rate.
After the shipments had already taken place, pursuant to the first rate, which had been approved before the shipments took place.
They tried to get the carrier to ante up the difference. To lower down the difference to the second prescription.
The shippers sued for reparations.
Right.
And their claim was disallowed.
Correct.
Now, why is that inconsistent with your position here? I mean, with the position of your opponents here?
Well, in both cases, in the Arizona case, and as we submit the situation in this case, the rate order cannot be retroactively adjusted. And so in Arizona...
Well, after it's been finally approved by the commission, then. But here, we're not doing that, are we? I mean, we're not being asked to do that.
Well, we claim that the San Antonio 1 rate order is the only legitimate, valid rate order that's stood the test of administrative procedure and was sanctioned by a reviewing court. I recognize that the record and the briefs are laced with these opinions about its interim nature and its temporal nature, but the Interstate Commerce Act doesn't provide for temporal orders or short-term orders. It just requires orders.
Well, I understand your argument. I'm just not quite clear on why the Arizona rate case provides you as much support as you think it does.
Well, we take our actions in many ways were guided by this court's discussion in Arizona Grocery, where it said where the commission prescribes a rate, it speaks in its legislative capacity, and it says $10. And that $10 must govern. The carriers cannot take their pricing freedom and try $15, throw it in the front door, file a tariff as you will, make us pay, make us litigate and take their chances. They say that the $10 prescription governs, and that is fundamentally what our position boils down to before this court this morning, that at the completion of the activities of the circuit court, the San Antonio 1 rate order stood in full force and effect, continued, as Judge Wilkie found, and that order set a specific rate, and under this court's ruling in Arizona, that is the only legal lawful rate, and they cannot vary it by filing tariffs or by any other means. Their relief was not to engage in this withering array of lawsuits and legal actions and maneuverings, but to go back to the commission and seek to act upon the circuit's mandate, just as they did when they were dissatisfied with the Eighth Circuit. They went back and they made their case to try to modify the prescription, and that would have been their best course of relief following the action of the D.C. Circuit.
Let me try again. If we were to reverse the Court of Appeals and vacate its judgment, then is San Antonio 3 rate structure the prevailing rate for this whole period?
Yes. In other words, thinking about that here, in other words, if you reverse if you reverse Wilkie, or stated differently, what we contend happens at the end of the circuit court's activities is that the price constraint continues. These people are continued under the regulatory rate ceiling, And they seek a result that at the end of the circuit court's action, the ceiling is gone. They're back to voluntary pricing. So taken on balance, if you were to reverse the D.C. Circuit, you would, in essence, be restoring pricing freedom to these railroads over our traffic because there wouldn't be any constraining rate orders at all.
And if we affirm the Court of Appeals, then San Antonio 1 rates are applicable and it's open to them to try to get an increase.
Correct. And indeed, the day after the circuit court, it was open to them. The circuit court never interfered with anything that the ICC could have done.
That still leaves a couple of years of rates at the San Antonio 1 level long after the San Antonio 1 tariff was filed.
No, it leaves. I think the time period is about 6 or 7 months or 8 months.
How much money would be involved?
I believe the figure has been computed at approximately $19 million. I've never figured out. I don't contest it. As you perhaps appreciate, the numbers in these coal rate cases are very, very, very enormous. So if you were to affirm the court below, the effect of your holding would be that the San Antonio 1 rate order continued until the commission finally vacated it back in April of 1981. The last point that I shall make very briefly is that the most understandable part of the presentation of my opponents is this facade of how they get the San Antonio 1 rate order to self-destruct or to have been lifted or vacated. And I simply want to say that the record in this case before the commission shows that the railroads were intensely trying to vacate the order, to lift it, to get out from under this pricing constraint. And we were resisting it steadfastly throughout the course of the proceedings. And so to come before this court now and say that the existence of this order, which is of such critical significance to this litigation and to my clients, is a metaphysical or semantical, really belies the fact. Everybody, including the circuit court and the commission, were acutely aware of the distinction between vacating or lifting an order and modifying it. And we submit that no case can be made on the facts of this record that the San Antonio 1 order somehow had gone out of existence before it got to the D.C. Circuit.
May I ask one other question about the consequences of an affirmance? You don't take the position that the May 7th order of the commission, where they allowed, pursuant to which you've been paying the higher rate, that was invalid, do you?
Well, we had some doubts about it, but those doubts did not
In other words, what I'm really asking is, if you win, are you entitled to
no.
Recover we're really the excess of over the San Antonio 1 rate for the period subsequent to May 7, 81?
Well, that issue is pending at the Interstate Commerce Commission as to what the
it seems to me one possible consequence of your view would be that the revival of the San Antonio 1 rates required that be the ceiling until
it was vacated
till today.
We take the position that be the ceiling until it was properly vacated, and the commission vacated it last May.
And that was consistent, in your view, with they were permitted to do that
right,
under the
absolutely.
Court of Appeals
They
mandate.
Were permitted to get to work on that the afternoon of Judge Wilkie's decision. Nothing that the circuit court did in any way interfered with that. Our difficulty was that we felt that the process that led to the vacation might have been a little summary, but fortunately that's not before
But for purposes
court.
Of our analyzing your argument here, we can assume that you accept the validity of the May 7th action of the
that
May 7th,
correct.
81 action of the commission.
Yes, Your Honor.
Could that afternoon, without a hearing or anything else, could the commission have amended its San Antonio 1 order to the extent that it just permitted could it just have withdrawn it that afternoon?
We would have argued that they could not have. We would have suggested and contended, as we did before the Fifth Circuit, that something in the nature of the defective hearing that they held that Wilkie found difficulties with should have been reheard.
So you don't think they could have done something to the order that would have permitted the railroads to file new tariffs immediately?
Well, I guess the question there is one of how much they could have done. They, in fact, did do something very summarily, and that has clearly been accepted by the courts. So my answer to your question, with the benefit of hindsight, is that, yes, they could have acted expeditiously. And indeed, Your Honor, the railroads could have asked the D.C. Circuit not to vacate the order. As we point out, many of the litigants in these rate cases come before the circuit court and say, it's a lousy order, but don't vacate it. We need it for the duration.
I take it the commission, the position now is that now is that the railroad tariffs that were filed based on San Antonio 3 are still in effect. Never were.
Well, as has been pointed out, the commission's position is a little like a chameleon here. At one time, their position was as ours is, and at another time, they took the position that
Well, at some point in this proceeding, the commission took the position that the railroad tariffs that were on file were the governing rates.
Right.
That is, in effect, saying the railroad should be permitted to file a new tariff at the San Antonio 3 level.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do you have anything further, Mr. Martin?
I'd like to address a couple of the questions that have been raised. First, with respect to where the filed rate doctrine was raised in our papers before the D.C. Circuit, in the first argument section of the petition for clarification that we filed in November, pages 11 through 12, is in response to Justice O'Connor's question. I'd like to address the Chief Justice's question with respect to what happens if we reverse or if we don't reverse it. If there is a reversal, our argument would be that everybody is protected because the entire matter of what happens to the rate from 1978, when San Antonio 2 came down, to the present and through tomorrow will be before the commission, and the commission will rule on what would have been a reasonable maximum rate throughout that entire period and can protect everybody, including San Antonio. The problem is, what happens if you don't? And here we have, from 1978...
What can the commission do, did you say? What rates have been charged up to now?
From 1978 to 79, the San Antonio 2 level was charged.
Mm-hmm.
From 79 until 80, mm-hmm. the San Antonio 3 level was charged.
May 80. Mm-hmm.
Yes, from July 80.
The commission cannot get the railroads to give up any of those collected rates.
Yes, sir. Because
on what basis?
Because the issue of the validity of the maximum rate that the railroads charged from 78 to 80 was the question that was before the commission in San Antonio 3. It went before the D.C. Circuit. The D.C. Circuit remanded it, and it's still on remand. So I think that's very important. Before the commission right now, there is a proceeding. In which it is ongoing. The commission will someday decide what would have been a maximum reasonable rate for this entire period. And if it finds that
I think it's your colleague on the other side doesn't agree with that. I understood him to say that if we reversed, there was no way that a reasonable rate could be set for this interim period.
No, if that's what he said, he's wrong, because the problem is with respect to the hole in the middle. The whole, it's 1978 to the present, and the issue of the maximum rate is before the commission right now. But if San Antonio is right, then there is a chunk of that period from July of 1980 to May of 1981 in which the commission would not have jurisdiction to decide what's a maximum reasonable rate. So the commission could, according to his theory, find that the San Antonio 2 level was okay from 78 to 79, the San Antonio 3 level was okay from 79 to 80, but there's a dip for 9 months in which the commission has no power to do anything because of the D.C. Circuit's decision. And then from May of 1981 on, again, jurisdiction would revert to the commission to find what's a maximum reasonable rate. Our theory is that there's no hole, that the commission has jurisdiction over the entire period.
If The Court of Appeals is reversed. The status quo ante is restored, I take it?
The carrier's tariff is on file today, Your Honor. Back in May of 1981, the Commission, in the decision that is in the Brown Book 5, restored pricing freedom to the carriers.
Can they recover from San Antonio the shortfall in the interim?
If you reverse, we will be able to go back and collect from them for that interim period of 9 months our tariff. And then, if the Commission decides that the tariff was too high for that period or any other portion of this four-year period, it can require us, yes, sir, to pay reparations and to pay interest. Now, I would like to address the point that was made about San Antonio 1 being the only constraining force on the railroads, and you have to somehow affirm the Court of Appeals because it's the only constraining force. That just isn't right, because from 1978 to 80, it didn't exist, and it doesn't exist today. I would like to call the Court's attention to the Appendix F-11, which is where the May 7, 1981 order appears. And as of that date and that order, San Antonio 1, on everybody's theory, is gone. Everybody's. Judge Wilkie acknowledged it in his decision at A6. So that is gone. And the Commission has jurisdiction over the entire period to implement the standards of the Act. And the only question is whether there's a nine-month chunk in the middle of that four-year period over which it has no jurisdiction and over which it has no alternative except to restore a rate which it believes is out of date by years, is inconsistent with its statutory standards. Again, a brief reference at F7 and F8 of the record. We don't have to speculate about what the Commission's intent is, at least today. Because we know in May of 1981, it got out this decision in which it said that the San Antonio 1 rate is supported neither by current cost data or current legal standards, or at least that there's no reason to believe it is, that not even San Antonio contends that its evidence would ultimately justify reimposition of the San Antonio 1 prescription. This is the Commission in May of 81. It says that the San Antonio 1 rate, if restored, would be way below even the threshold for Commission maximum rate jurisdiction, and a rate of that kind, quote, cannot have continued validity. This is at F8 of the record. So we know what the Commission's view is in the wake of the remand. We know what the Commission's view is in 1980-81. We don't have to speculate about it.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. The United States against...